So we're in the home straight. We're going to look at the big issues confronting BCA and our members. And to introduce the session, a man whose voice you might have heard occasionally on the radio, particularly if you'd listened to Vision Australia Radio at midnight, because he runs in there every night of the year and tells us that we're about to cross to the BBC, as if we didn't know it. Ladies and gentlemen, make welcome Stephen Jolly.
Thank you, John. You're giving my tricks away there. And thank you to John and to the organising committee for what's been a very interesting day and a great day to be part of. And our session this afternoon, I think it's called The Big Issues. I think it's actually more big issues when we reflect on what we've been talking about earlier today with NDIS and My Aged Care. And then some of the issues that came up this afternoon as well. But they continue to be big ones that we have. We're going to look at audio description, particularly audio description on television. We're going to look at the Marrakesh Copyright Treaty and where we're up to with that and what it will mean for us here in Australia. We're going to look at touchscreen technology and also, of course, BCA, where it is and what's on the agenda in the future. So we've got quite a panel with us. We've got Lauren Henley, who's going to talk about the audio description, Anthony Taylor from Vision Australia to talk about the Marrakesh Treaty. Ricky Chaplin will be talking about the touch screen technology, and our hardworking President Emma Bennison for the BCA, which will be sort of like a lead into the session later on. So what we might do, depending on how timing's going, is hold back questions around the BCA matters for part of that discussion at 5 o'clock. And I cleared that approach with the President earlier today, so I think I'll be all right for suggesting it. So let's start now with a very big one, audio description. Lauren's going to talk about that for about 10 minutes, and we'll take the presentations and then the questions. Lauren Henley has been involved with BCA for quite some time around policy and advocacy. She now works, as well as with BCA, with the Youth Disability Advocacy Service in Victoria. And one of her passions is audio description on television. And I learnt this particularly when we first talked about it, and Lauren made me realise that for some of us lifers who have never watched television, because we've been blind all our life, for us it's a good one, a great development, but for some people it will really make a difference because it'll bring back what they used to have direct access to. So here's Lauren to give us the perspective on where things are with audio description on television.
Thanks, Stephen. Before we get started, just in case we do have anyone here today who is quite new to the organisation and hasn't heard of audio description, or in case we have anyone streaming, audio description is the verbal narration of visual representations like television programs, films and live performances. So in between gaps in dialogue, what happens is there's a narrated voice that will come on and describe visual elements that are happening, like scenes, settings, actions and costumes. And today I'm talking specifically about audio description on television. I have to say I'm actually having a bit of a deja vu moment, because I think this time about 3 years ago I was probably sitting in a similar venue talking to a group of BCA members, possibly some of the same ones, about audio description on television. And while I'd really like to tell you that we've been successful in getting a permanent audio description service on Australian television since this time, what I can report is that we're getting closer. First though, let's review the facts. Australia is the only English-speaking country that does not have a permanent audio description service on television, although all Australian broadcasters have been required to provide captioning for people who are deaf for many years now. The ABC has now undertaken two trials of audio description, because they were dragged kicking and screaming, but they are still not committed to establishing a permanent service on Australian television. The most recent of these trials didn't reach broadcast television. It was delivered on the ABC's catch-up service, iView. Those who accessed the trial were really pleased with the audio description service until it was taken out from underneath them a couple of months ago when the trial came to an end. Some people may recall that several years ago, BCA lodged 21 complaints with the Australian Human Rights Commission. These complaints were lodged against the ABC for their failure to provide a permanent audio description service. Eventually, the complaints were terminated because a satisfactory outcome was not reached with the ABC through conciliation. From the date of termination, we had 60 days to file the matter in court if we wanted to pursue it further. The trouble is, though, BCA needed to rely on one of the original 21 complainants who would be committed enough to the cause to bring the case against the ABC on their own. And someone did step up. That person was BCA member Susie Hudson. Susie's matter will be heard at the Federal Circuit Court in Sydney on the 12th, 13th and 14th of December this year. If you know people who are blind or vision impaired who are living in or near Sydney, please encourage them to go along and support Susie during the hearing. Crystal Keller, Executive Officer of Blind Citizens New South Wales, will be trying to coordinate an attendance schedule to make sure there'll be representation from people who are blind or vision impaired across all 3 days. So if people are planning on going, it'd be great if they could give Crystal a call and let her know. While this has all been happening, I've been pursuing my own complaints, and this too has been some 18 months in the making. The Broadcasting Services Act is the act that sets out minimum targets for captioning on Australian television, and it's this act that needs to be amended to ensure that audio description will be a legislated requirement for all Australian broadcasters. To support the work being done by Susie Hudson, and to come at things from a slightly different angle, I lodged a complaint against the Australian government instead of one single broadcaster. This complaint was not lodged under the Disability Discrimination Act like Susie's was. Instead, it was lodged under the United Nations Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, because the convention had better coverage for the argument that I was trying to make. The convention says that countries that have ratified the convention, of which Australia is one, must take all appropriate measures to ensure people with disability enjoy access to television programs, films, theatre, and other cultural activities in accessible formats. The convention also says that governments must take all legislative, administrative and other measures for the implementation of the rights set out in the convention. In my complaint, I referred to the Australian Human Rights Commission Act as well. The Act says that the Australian Human Rights Commission has the power to inquire into any act or practice that may be inconsistent with or contrary to any human right. My complaint was supported by a solicitor from the Public Interest Advocacy Centre, the same agency that's provided legal support for Susie Hudson's case. The solicitor helped me redraft my complaint to include relevant precedents, showing how the law has been applied in other situations. Sometime after the complaint had been accepted by the Australian Human Rights Commission, the Commission notified us that they were no longer investigating the complaint because they believed it was misconceived or lacking in substance, and then the complaint was terminated. My solicitor was actually far more infuriated than I was because she's been doing this sort of work for years and she knows how the law works. She's seen this sort of thing happen before, and the sad fact is that while Australia has an obligation to uphold the rights set out in the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, our own Australian Human Rights Commission continuously fails to take matters lodged under the Convention seriously. If the Australian Human Rights Commission won't uphold our rights, then who will? My solicitor believed the Commission had made an error of law in the treatment of my case, so we filed the matter to be reviewed in court. My case will be heard in Sydney on the 29th of November this year. Because it's only an administrative decision that relates to the way the Human Rights Commission dealt with the complaints, it should only take a couple of hours at most, but it's likely the decision won't be handed down until early next year. If I win, it means the Commission has to accept the complaint and investigate it properly, but it also means we've set a precedent to tell the Human Rights Commission they have a responsibility to take these matters seriously. And if I lose, I still kind of win, because the next step is to lodge a complaint at the international level through the Committee on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. Now, you might have noticed that the Public Interest Advocacy Centre has been a key player in this space. I can't thank them enough for their continued commitment to the needs of people who are blind or vision impaired, but they're still looking at other avenues to help us fight the good fight. Quite some time ago, Green Senator Rachel Seward said that she would support a private members' bill on audio description in the Parliament. So PIAC has seized this opportunity, so that's the Public Interest Advocacy Centre. In consultation with organisations across the blindness sector, they've written drafting instructions for a proposed private members' bill that, if passed, would amend the Broadcasting Services Act to introduce minimum requirements for audio description on Australian television. But it might still be a little while before we see where that one goes. It's a bit of a watch this space at the moment, but the next 12 months are going to be pretty big for us, and we're getting closer to getting something over the line. A few months ago, I was talking to someone from one of the companies that produces audio-described content here in Australia. They told me they've already had extensive conversations about audio description with several television networks because the networks know that it's only going to be a matter of time before they're required to provide it. Some people might think we're mad for not having given up by now, but Rome wasn't built in a day. Real systemic change doesn't happen overnight, and as long as you don't give up, you haven't failed. Now, to finish on a positive front, audio description is available on online streaming service Netflix. All Netflix original series are audio described, and Netflix has also committed to purchasing audio described tracks for more third-party movies and TV shows into the future. We're also starting to see more audio described content on the iTunes store. Just type in the words audio description and see what comes up. The list is growing all the time. That's about all I have to say on audio description for now, but I'm looking forward to hearing your questions during question time. Thanks.
Good on you, Lauren. Thank you for that, Lauren Henley. I'd just like to take this opportunity to thank the blindness and low vision community across Australia who supported the petition that we had in my name on change.org last year about audio description on television. I think we got about 1,300 signatures to that. It's still going, by the way. And every little bit helps with the weight. So thank you to all those who did support that. We now move to issues of reading and the Marrakesh Treaty, which we all heard so much about when it was adopted some years ago. And Anthea will talk in more detail about that, but it's really about an arrangement whereby works that are created, reading material created in accessible form, can be shared across boundaries, and we don't have the sort of duplication that we've had in the past. But there's a lot to get that into place, and there are significant benefits for Australia that we'd like to hear about now. From Anthea Taylor. Anthea is a senior member of Vision Australia in the library area. She joined the library in 2013 and now heads up the library service. So she's in touch with library content all the time and looking for more efficient ways to get it to library members. Anthea, thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you everybody for, and especially John, for inviting me to talk about this. As those of you who know me, this is quite an interest and passion of mine. When I moved from my previous work at the Gordon TAFE in Geelong under education, copyright was one of my portfolios, and I was also completing a graduate diploma in intellectual property law. So all of a sudden, my research papers shifted from education to the Marrakesh Treaty. So the Marrakesh Treaty to facilitate access to published works for persons who are blind, visually impaired or otherwise print disabled. Throughout, I'll probably refer to it as the Marrakesh Treaty or, when you're with friends, which I am, just the treaty, because everybody knows what we're talking about. It was adopted by the members of the States of the World Intellectual Property Organisation on the 27th of June 2013. But this wasn't a quick adoption. It took many years, decades of discussions, negotiations, of lobbying, and as we know, Marianne Diamond was instrumental in getting it through, getting it up. But it didn't stop there from the signing and the agreement. It required 20 countries at a minimum to ratify, to make it formal within their parliaments. Australia ratified on the 10th of December in 2016, but we were about country 16, 17. And it wasn't until Canada ratified on the 30th of June this year that they became the 20th country, therefore enabling the treaty to come into force 3 months after that, so the 30th of September. So that's when all the fun and excitement began, because that meant we were allowed to start implementing the treaty. So far to date, there are 25 countries who've ratified, but there are still very many more to go, such as the big players, the US, the UK and Europe, especially for Australia, for us to make use of English language. We do need those countries to ratify. But also for our emerging countries, it's important that we start negotiating with India, with Israel, which I've already started communications with the libraries in these countries. What's important about this particular treaty is that it provides exceptions to the copyright protections for individuals or beneficiaries, as it's known in the treaty, or organisations, which are known as authorised entities, to reproduce or send accessible material in Australia and across borders. It is the first copyright-based treaty to focus on the consumer. And as Stephen said, it's very important because it's about exchanging rather than duplicating. It establishes an authorised network of accessible format distributors. In turn, it's reducing the costs, again, because we can exchange rather than duplicate. It also provides a framework to protect the commercial interests of rights holders by requiring people first to seek purchasing material rather than relying on the treaty. Now, that is the current situation under the current Copyright Act, but with the treaty, it very much specifies that it's about the format to suit the person. At the moment, in the current Act, it is pretty unclear. The ratification of the treaty also signifies that the country will ensure their domestic copyright laws apply, and I'll talk a little bit more about Australia's in a minute. The Department of Communications, the Copyright Agency in Australia, and Senator Mitch Fifield's advisor on the Marrakesh Treaty all advised us that Australia's copyright law is compliant with the requirements of the treaty. However, the current law is not perfect in relation to print disabilities. We do work under specific exceptions. Part 5A is a licensing exception. Okay, that's okay. We know what we can do and can't do under that. Section 200AB, which many of you will have heard about before, is not so clear. And we, as a vision and as an industry and as a sector, aren't the only people who find this particular section unclear. There are different legal interpretations and advice on the accessible format and commercial availability. As part of the consultation process leading up to the initial agreement, then the ratification, many organisations and individuals submitted comments and recommendations to the Department of Communications about suggested changes to the current Copyright Act to align with the provisions and the requirements of the treaties. Now, there are some organisations, publishers included, that argued for no change. But the result is that there is a proposed bill, the Copyright Disability Access and Others Measures Bill. It is currently with the Department of Communications, and we're waiting to hear when it will be put forward to Parliament for consideration and hopefully for passing. And the idea behind this is to consolidate existing limitations and exceptions. So it replace the statutory licence, which is part 5A, and it will give streamlined exceptions in relation to the copyright material. But more importantly, it will replace 200AB, the unclear provision, with a fair dealing exception, meaning that we can change and make accessible copies because it is fair dealing. So where this leads to, what is it? What's in it for us? Now, Emma and I were very lucky on Tuesday to meet at a forum in Sydney hosted by the Australia's Publishers Association, bringing together stakeholders to start talking about how Australia is going to implement the treaty. And I think what we came out with, that the treaty, it provides opportunities. Opportunities for increased access to titles in accessible format, hundreds and thousands of them, because we will also be able to access materials from our friends and our partners within other organisations internationally. It's used as an instrument of change. It's also about improving the awareness and knowledge of accessibility, and I think shifting the culture to one of equity and universal access. It's about breaking down the challenges faced by print disabled. And I think Emma and I can both say that we think that that was one of the outcomes from Tuesday, especially with the publishers. Yeah. And that leads on to it starting to open the dialogue with publishers and authors so that we work together to publish their titles in accessible formats in the first instance. We were very clear about saying that Born Accessible and Universal Design was the ultimate for us. It's also about providing access to clean files for reformatting, including human narration. It's an opportunity to promote Australian content to the rest of the world. It's an opportunity to create a sustainable commercial market for accessible format titles. It's an opportunity to develop and undertake agreed standards. And it's an opportunity to build on a global database of what is available. For all of this, to sum it up, for me, the Marrakesh Treaty, it's the opportunity to create greater access to reading materials, whether it's recreation or information. This leads to greater access for education, employment, social inclusion and participation, independence and equity. And none of those terms would be unfamiliar to you because they're all human rights. Thank you.
Was there something else you wanted to mention?
Sorry, yes, because I was so conscious that I only had 10 minutes. But I also didn't mention them with the symbolic exchange between the CNIB, the Canadian National Institute for the Blind, and Vision Australia. When we worked with WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organisation, CNIB and VA, Vision Australia, over many nights, over different hours and time zones, because there was a commitment from all three organisations for the first symbolic transfer and exchange to happen. And there certainly is a commitment to the Accessible Book Consortium across the globe. And I think it was great that Australia was leading the way in that. Thank you.
Thank you. And bonus applause for that little extra. Thanks, Anthea. And we'll have a chance for questions for you very shortly. Now, I remember reading on my Vision Australia device back in 2006 on the train about these new phones coming out called iPhones, and they were touchscreen things and probably be mainly video stuff on them, and I sort of said, oh, that's not really for me, but I'll read it anyway. Well, how wrong could I have been about a touchscreen device not being relevant? But the battle's not over, and touchscreens continue to be there, and we have to keep catching up all the time with accessibility. And one of our champions in the community working to get that right is Ricky Chaplin, and Ricky is Policy and Advocacy Officer with Blind Citizens Australia.
Careful.
We'll keep going. With Blind Citizens Australia, and Ricky, it'd be good to hear from you now to find out where we are with combating the challenges of this technology.
Okay, thank you, Stephen. I'm going to focus on the touchscreen machine or FPOS machine released by the Commonwealth Bank, known as the Albert. Some of you may have run across an Albert before, but many of you still may have not done so yet. The reason being that Alberts are primarily distributed among small businesses at this point, so you don't see them in Coles or Woolworths or big places like that. However, when you do run across an Albert, it can be quite a shock. And certainly all of the complainants who I'm assisting, who have lodged complaints with the Australian Human Rights Commission about this device, certainly experienced that. So let's tell you first a bit about the device. The Albert is a touchscreen FPOS machine. It's based on an Android tablet, so it's quite a lot bigger than an iPhone, actually quite heavy. It's only got basically two buttons on a home button or menu button and a power button. That's pretty much it. It does have a headphone jack, and you can plug headphones in and operate the device in that way. Now, the catch with this device is that accessibility mode on the device, yes, there is an accessibility mode available, but it has to be activated by the retailer. So, in other words, the consumer at this point in time cannot activate the accessibility function on that device. We have worked with the Commonwealth Bank to try and distribute instructions to people to tell retailers how to do that, but that's still by no means a foolproof method of being able to have that accessibility device activated. But that's not the end of the story, because once the accessibility device is activated, many people are still not familiar with the gestures that are required to be able to enter one's PIN number if you need to do that. If you have a purchase that's under $100, you can use the PayPass facility, of course, on your ATM card. However, many people choose not to do that, and that's perfectly understandable. So what's happening is that if, A, the retailer has not been trained in how to turn on accessibility mode and how the accessibility mode works, and B, the consumer has never seen an Elbit before, often what happens is that people are forced to disclose their PIN numbers, which, of course, goes against all of the advice and, indeed, just common sense of the major banks. So there's a number of issues here, and the need to disclose one's PIN number in many circumstances is the first of those. So assuming that you get the accessibility activated, there's a 10-minute tutorial that you have to go through in order to understand how this thing works. So you can just imagine other customers lining up behind you while you're waiting to go through this 10-minute tutorial and figure out how this device works. You're then put in a situation where you're under pressure to get the gestures right, enter the PIN number with no actual feedback about whether you've entered the number correctly. It just tells you that you've entered a number. It doesn't say which number it is, because, of course, this thing talks, and so what they're worried about is other people overhearing your PIN number. So that is an added complication there as well. Okay, so we've talked about the accessibility mode being activated by the retailer rather than the consumer. The rest of the functions on the machine actually aren't accessible at all. So if you're a small business owner, you can't actually do all of the things that other small business owners can do, because this machine is capable of having other apps that are of great assistance to people in small business, and that's why this system was introduced in the first place. So it is, by nature, a fairly still a fairly inaccessible beast. The training that the Commonwealth Bank is saying that that retailers are receiving clearly isn't reaching many people. Just about in all instances where complaints have been lodged, people have said that the retailers they've been to have not been aware of how to activate that accessibility mode. And the video tutorials that are available, most people couldn't make sense of them. Add to that, you have situations where there are potential language and cultural barriers. So you're simply getting situations where people aren't understanding the training and they don't understand why it's important that they should know how to activate accessibility mode, or indeed what accessibility is. So I think that kind of sums up what the issues are around this machine and its use. So there have been about 8 complaints lodged with my assistance to the Australian Human Rights Commission, and at this stage it looks like the conciliation for those complaints is going to be in January. A couple of people, including Graeme Innes, and I'm sure he won't mind me saying because he has publicly said so, are getting assistance through the Public Interest Advocacy Centre, and that's fantastic. So a couple of people have that extra assistance, and that's really good. So we're seeking some common resolutions here to these issues. Of course, number one is, and we've said this even when they were doing trials at Vision Australia with the Albert last year, the user or the consumer must be able to turn on accessibility mode. So there's a couple of different ways you could do it. There is the good old triple home button tap, as is with the iPhone. There has been a suggestion that you could plug a set of headphones in and that would activate the accessibility mode. So there's certainly ways of being able to do it. But at this stage, that's not happening. And so we must get that to happen. We're not negotiable on that one. Training for retailers, as I mentioned, is not effective. And so we have to work more proactively with the bank and be consulted about how this training is delivered. Training itself, though, is not the entire answer. So the availability of a device with a keyboard or the implementation of a keyboard on the actual device is also required. And I think one of the complaints in particular, which illustrates this very well, is there's one lady who has an acquired brain injury. She is not able to remember the swiping gestures that are required from one time to another. She has short-term memory loss, and so that's just incredibly difficult. And plus her issues with coordination make the use of a touchscreen in general impossible for her. So I think that presents a very strong case for why a keyboard is required on this device, or the older style machines are made available. Now, the Commonwealth Bank are actually saying that they're not taking the older style machines away from the retailers, but that's not what we're hearing based on the complaints we've received. And even if they are there, there's no guarantee that the older style machines remain connected to the server. So that's pretty much a workaround solution. okay, and of course, the availability of these machines, you know, at around at different places, so among blindness agencies, at Commonwealth Bank branches, etc. I think the Commonwealth Bank are fairly amenable to that. But even so, none of these issues on their own, or none of these resolutions on their own, are going to stand up. They must all be incorporated, really, for this system to be able to work successfully and be accessible for everybody. So I'll move on from just the Albert machine itself to the importance of getting touchscreen technology accessible from day one. So as we've seen with the development of the iPhone, it's entirely possible to make touchscreen technology accessible. I like to think about touchscreen technology in terms of in two different ways. So on a microwave, for example, where you've got a 1 minute button, a 10 minute button, 1 second button, etc. Those buttons are quite able to be modified. You can put a tactile marker on them and they always remain the same. But with machines like the Albert and the iPhone and other Android phones, you have what I call dynamic menus. So the menus change. Every time you press a button, you get a whole series of different options. And unless those options are made accessible to you, you have no idea what they're going to be. So it's really important that we work on getting the touchscreen devices and their menus accessible right from the get-go. I think what the Commonwealth Bank's done is to develop a device. They apparently consulted somebody, one engineer who has a vision impairment, and presumably just thought that it was going to work for everybody because he could work it out.
Thanks, Ricky. We're going to need to wrap up.
Okay. All right. We'll finish there, but that's what we've been working on thus far. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Yes, a lot of problems, not many solutions with that one, but thank you, Ricky Chaplin, for that. Now, Emma, did you want to make any comments at this stage in response to or adding to what the previous three speakers have been talking about?
Not specifically, only to say that as you can see, we've covered a fair bit of ground on this panel in a fairly short space of time, and these are only some of the issues that we're dealing with, both within BCA, but in the sector more broadly. And so, I think this gives you an idea of why an organisation like BCA working alongside the blindness service providers in this sector is absolutely crucial, so that we do have a strong and independent voice. So, I mean, that's probably all I need to say, really. And also congratulations to the three panel members for a really fantastic summary of all three of the of those issues.
Yes, here, here. Thank you. What we might do now is, if it's okay with you, Emma, is take further discussion from the floor on these three areas: audio description, the treaty, or touchscreen technology, and then I'll hand over to Emma, and we'll sort of slide into the rest of the session. Yeah,
and we might get Dan and John to come up at that point too.
So, any questions from the floor or comments? Nadia.
Hi, Stephen. Just to reiterate on what Ricky was saying, along with Graeme Innes, I'm the other person who has been fortunate enough to get the support of PIAC for my complaint against the Commonwealth Bank and the Albert disaster. it's not really a question, it's just really a comment. I gave it a lot of thought before I lodged my complaint, because I wasn't sure how far it would get. I wasn't really encouraged by the discussions that I'd had with organisations that had been involved in the trialling of these systems. They clearly raised the issues that I had come across, and yet the Commonwealth Bank really didn't take any of that. It appears that the Commonwealth Bank really hasn't taken much of that feedback on, or done anything about a resolution to any of the issues that people had raised. But having now lodged a complaint and getting support from PIAC, I'd just like to encourage other people, if you do come across one of these machines, it really is absolutely important that you think seriously about lodging a complaint about one of these machines, because it's not only the Commonwealth Bank that will be, or that have started to introduce these machines, it will be other banks, because they offer vendors and merchants a lot of options, a lot of apps that you can download, a lot of, you can split bills, you can probably cook your breakfast on them, I've got no idea, but you can, there's a lot of opportunity there for development of more intuitive machines.
Yeah.
And if you don't complain about them, nothing will get done.
Thank you, Nadia. Right. Are there any other questions or comments? Any more about Marrakesh or the audio description? We've given Albert a fair belting.
It's Gary Adler. Just on the question of audio description, what exactly is the issue? Is it technology? Is it a reluctance of the networks to really get involved? Because my understanding with my connections in New Zealand is that it's been very successful there, but I believe from what I've been told that it is also to do with, in part, technology. Is that correct, or is it a combination of both?
So back in 2012, was it 2012? I can't remember.
Yes.
They did a trial of audio description on broadcast television. So that was on ABC One. And that was basically to test out the technical aspects and see if it could be delivered successfully. And there were a few back of house issues, but it was more because it was a temporary thing and they hadn't put the appropriate systems in place to be delivering a service long term. We know it can be done. The technical side of it is not an issue. The technology is there. We know from going through the complaints process with the ABC, however, they don't feel that it's discrimination not providing us with access to television, even though I'm a taxpayer and I'm funding this service. Mm. So I think, like a lot of things, companies don't do accessibility unless they're forced to. So it really does come down to the legislation. And until we get that change, I don't think broadcasters are going to come to the party.
Actually, just to add to that,
Emma.
In fact, the ABC has made it very clear that they see television as a visual medium, and that therefore audio description is an add-on rather than a, you know, a required service for people who are blind or vision impaired.
Yeah, and we're reminded of what Emma was, Lauren was saying earlier about how Australia is behind other English-speaking countries. So we've got to change the ABC's thinking there, and not just
and it's not just the ABC either.
I think a common thread among issues like touchscreen technology, audio description, is that there is a continual deflection of responsibility. The banks are trying to deflect responsibility onto the retailers in the case of touchscreen technology, or Elbit. The ABC is trying to deflect responsibility onto the federal government because it costs money and they don't want to pay out, etc., etc. I think we need to get the message across by acting on these issues that accessibility is everybody's business.
Yeah.
I'll take one more question or quick comment.
Janine Sardou here.
Hey, Janine.
A lot of people in this room know of my interest in audio description. I know the ones who have been around a while will remember that audio description was done on Vision Australia Radio in connection with some television programs. I know, Stephen, yours has got taken over by the ABC in some form or other with the tennis. But Carols by Candlelight is one of Vision Australia's projects that they do every year, and that used to be audio described on Vision Australia Radio. Hasn't been for the last few years, and I know some people miss it, including me. So I just wondered, I know that we shouldn't be taking away responsibility from the television presenters doing it, or maybe Channel 9 should be looking at it, but I'm just hoping that someone will look at it again, because those of us who like it every year would like to know what's happening. Thank you.
Thank you, Janine. I just quickly want to take the opportunity to acknowledge the long-standing work of one of our great fighters, New South Wales peer Bruce Maguire, who's done a lot of work in this area, and of course he's advocacy work goes right back to 2000 and sorting out the Olympics website. So I just want to make that point that Bruce continues to make a very strong contribution in the audio description and in the touchscreen technology as well as other areas. We will close this session now. Yes, go on, Lauren.
Where's the microphone?
I just wanted to quickly make an acknowledgement, and Susie Hudson probably isn't streaming online. I don't know. She might be. Hi, Susie. She's probably at the club, exactly. Good club girl, Susie. I just want everyone to put their hands together for what a great job Susie Hudson is doing for people who are blind or vision impaired throughout Australia, because it's a real commitment she's made to the cause and she's really fighting it. So can everyone put their hands together for Susie?
So thank you, everyone, for your to our speakers for their participation, Anthony, Lauren, and also Ricky. And we'll take our leave now, and John and Dan will come back to the table to work with Emma for the next session. Thank you.
You can pat him.
I don't think I can, actually. Where are you? Oh, there you are. About half an hour. Okay. But don't say anything, because you can be heard.
What?
You can be heard. Actually, Dan.
Hello.
You might be on the other side, so you can share the microphone. And because Lucy's, can you move out? He's on Lucy's seat. He's just swapping.
That's what I was thinking, but I didn't
want
to say.
You can stay up here if you want. I want to say something smart. Okay,
we've got a microphone
next
now,
but Lucy,
you need to be quiet. Shush, Lucy, please. Otherwise, you'll... Okay. All right, are we ready?
Yep.
Okay, is this microphone on? Oh, yes.
Yep.
Okay, thank you, everybody. We're going to spend a bit of time talking about BCA and what the issues are that we're dealing with at present and what the future might look like. Most of this session, I think we're going to give over, though, to questions from the floor, because I think that I'm sure that you'll all have questions that we want to hear and we won't necessarily have thought of. But just to give you a little bit of an overview about the current happenings at BCA, first of all, to say, I guess the most immediate issue that some of you will have seen on the list in the past week is that, unfortunately, our temporary Chief Operations Officer, John Devine, has sadly had to resign due to ill health, and unfortunately it's had to take effect immediately. So that has not only been really disappointing because we've enjoyed the opportunity to work with John, but also very concerning that John's health is not good. So I really doubt that he's listening, but you never know. But we wish him all the best and a speedy recovery. But in the meantime, where we're at the moment is to just be thinking about next steps, and certainly making sure that the office can continue to function smoothly, and certainly to find someone to fill his shoes whilst, as we had always planned to do, we look at the process of recruitment for a new executive officer. We are doing some work around that, and one of the reasons that we wanted to take some time following Leah's departure to do that was so that we make sure that we've got that position right and make sure that we've got the settings right for the future, because BCA has actually undergone some fairly significant changes over the past 5 years or so, and we just need to make sure that that position is well aligned with the resource needs and the operational needs of the organisation, both in terms of its current funding situation, but also in terms of the current demand for services and, you know, peer support, people's peer support and advocacy needs. So that's something that's occupying a lot of my attention and the board's attention at the moment. Other than that, of course, as John alluded to before, John and I have been travelling around to the various forums, which has been, whilst a very exhausting experience, also a huge privilege and a really fantastic opportunity to connect with members all over the country. I've really enjoyed it. I've rekindled a lot of friendships and made a lot of new friends, and it's just been really, really great to actually have that face-to-face contact with members. So much as my family probably hasn't appreciated it, it has been a really exciting opportunity. So, and I hope that it's also been a useful opportunity for people to have John and I there to ask direct questions of and give us their ideas and feedback, and also to those of you who've been listening on the stream and texting in your questions, particularly one of our more active listeners, board member Stephen Belbin, who I think has been pretty much listening to every forum. Lauren Henley, on the other hand, seems to like to do the vacuuming while she's listening to the stream. So I'm glad you made it today, Lauren. I was a bit worried you might be too busy vacuuming to be here with us. But oh, you got a cleaner. Oh, great. All right. I didn't know you had the NDIS. Anyway, so that's been great. It's been really good to have that opportunity. Obviously, as we've been travelling around, and also earlier in the year, one of the big issues that we've been grappling with, and will continue to do so, is how to make sure that our structure reflects the needs of our membership. And we've certainly been looking at things like closer working relationships with Blind Citizens New South Wales. We've been looking at the proposal from the Adelaide branch to transition to a model where they change their name to Blind Citizens South Australia. And we've also been looking at, more recently, proposals from Queensland as well, wanting to have a state-based level of engagement. So obviously we have been wanting to look at that with a national, through a national lens, from a national perspective, and we are continuing to work through that process of ensuring that we get that structure right, so that we can have a state level of interaction with our members, but also, I guess one of the great things about that is to provide a bit of credibility at a state level for members when they, you know, when we need to do state-based advocacy, also to help, particularly where there are multiple branches in many states, to coordinate those branches. But we also recognise, and I'm conscious as I'm saying this, that of course we don't have a Melbourne branch at the moment, but we also recognise the importance of locally based activity. And it doesn't necessarily have to be branch through a branch structure, but the very significant role that locally based organised activity has to play in terms of peer support. So we've been looking at those things. We'll continue to do that with a view to making some constitutional amendments at the, not this coming AGM, of course, but the next one. And of course, that leads me to mention the upcoming AGM, which is happening in Sydney on the 26th of November. The reason for that is twofold. One, we wanted to combine our AGM with the Blind Citizens NSW annual meeting in recognition that we are building a closer working relationship with them. We also had hoped to be able to have a face-to-face board meeting on that weekend. We've had to postpone that due to the other issues that have overtaken us with John Devine's recent departure. So, but nevertheless, the AGM will proceed, of course, and we look forward to that very much. I might now see whether, first of all, whether Dan or John have got any comments that they'd like to add, because no doubt there are thousands of things that I've missed. And then we might open the floor for questions. So, John, first.
Thanks, Emma. I just want to take you back, though, Emma, because I think that one of the important developments, in fact, occurred last Saturday in Hobart, association with the forum there. And Doug McGinn standing at the door, and if you don't deal with this properly, he'll get you on the way out. But some great work done down there in terms of bringing members back together, and you might want to just touch on that briefly.
Yeah, it sort of eluded me because I live there, and it sort of just happened. Because we had such a great committee, two of whom are in the room. I'm not just saying that, though, because they're in the room. It really was a fantastic experience. I'm very excited about it. Very excited about the fact that we had 30 people at that forum, which is an extraordinary number of people for Tasmania. And there was an agreement that we wanted to continue to have opportunities to meet and both socially and also to talk about advocacy issues that are relevant to Tasmanians. And so that committee that organised the forum has now agreed and been tasked with continuing to come together to develop the next steps. And we're very committed to the fact that some of those will be social face-to-face opportunities for people to meet up and connect. But we also are very mindful of the fact that we actually had a couple of people travel quite long distances to be there on Saturday, and so we want to also have a teleconferencing opportunity for people as well. So we're going to do a combination of both, but it's really just very exciting to see the level of enthusiasm that was present in Tasmania last Saturday, and I'm sure I feel confident that's going to continue. So well, it's a watch this space, really. But, yeah, it was very great to be part of.
That was the only thing I want to raise. I don't know if Dan's got anything else.
I think it's terrific that we see John and Emma, so the president and vice president of the organisation, travelling to every single one of the state forums. And as the person in charge of finance and risk management for the organisation, I'm glad to see money going out the door paying for them to go around to this stuff. I think it's good. I think it's worthwhile.
Dale, that recording is working, isn't it?
this is a good investment for the organisation. And obviously, you know, the way we do this stuff every second year is the state conventions. And it's been a successful year. And I think it's testimony. There's a lot of activity around the country. But I really congratulate John and Emma, who've put in a lot of time to go to the various state forums around the country. So I think that's just really terrific, and my gratitude for them and their time to spend on that. But I'd love to hear from people in the room.
Mm. Yep. Yeah, I'll open up the floor for questions, and then we've just got a bit of an announcement to make as well, just to keep you in suspense. Mm-hmm. And also so that I don't forget and somebody reminds me. Has anyone got any questions, comments?
Come on, you're never this shy when you approach us one-to-one.
I'd love to hear from some people who haven't spoken too, if you want to ask, you know, that BCA should be doing something, or even if you think maybe you should know we should be doing something, just, you know, it's always good to hear from people about what you think the organisation should be doing.
And also, if anybody does want to text questions, Vaughan's happy to take questions. So the number is 0416118655. And that's on people on the stream or people in the room who don't feel inclined to speak publicly can do that. Sorry, 0416118655. I should have that right. I am married to him, after all.
Yes, question? Down the far side.
Yep. Thank you. It's Bill Jolly speaking. I don't think I've spoken since first thing this morning. I want to bring the discussion back to a little bit back to touch screens, but to wayfinding in general. We've have today the demonstration of the iBeacon technology, and so I'll come to that in a moment. Firstly, in relation to touchscreen technology, I recall an intervention on VipL, I think it was, from Rachel Keat, who works at 199 Elizabeth Street, at a big tall building there with 46 floors, or 52 it might be. It's a building where I used to work, actually, and she was lamenting that the lift system has changed. So they no longer have lifts that have speech and braille, but they have lifts that use touchscreens, and the touchscreen technology appears to be inaccessible. I don't exactly understand how it works, but apparently you press a button somewhere and then a display comes up and tells you which lift to go to, and then you get in the lift and whatever. It's quite difficult for blind people to use. I'd like to think that we're on the case here with this sort of touchscreen technology, which is going to become more widespread, and in particular, whether this sort of technology has been introduced into the lift standard. We used to be quite active there with Barry Chapman in the development and the changes to the lift standard. So I'd be interested in some comment about that. Then in relation to the iBeacon technology, we've had for many years, we've had tactile ground surface indicators, audible traffic signals. We've started to talk about Braille on street signs, which I tend to think is a solution for the past, not the future, and that we need to be looking to develop electronic methods of wayfinding and having those integrated into the relevant standards. So I'm interested in what work we're currently doing in relation to standards and the where we are in relation to the wayfinding standard, which is being revised. And of course, these things go into standards, then they're picked up by the building regulators, and then they go into building codes, and that's when they become law. But the first step is the standards.
I might have a first bite at that, Bill, of one of those several issues. I've never had a Bill Jolly question or comment that didn't have at least three dot points as its structure.
Yeah.
The lift issue, the first one of those types of lifts I came across where I was trying to get into a building was actually at a building in Sydney which now houses the Australian Human Rights Commission. And we have the someone in the room who was the Disability Discrimination Commissioner at the time. And I always meant to ask him how on earth did that happen, and I assume he actually did something about it, because I left Sydney soon after that, basically because of that. I could no longer live in a city with such an inaccessible human rights commission.
Do you have any comment, Graham?
I don't know if Graham, seriously, if you're able to make any sort of advocacy on that point, but I think these issues are worth our while in taking on and look. But as you say, Bill, it's a long road, and these things are happening quite quickly. The process of getting these things into standards and building codes and implemented is a long road. The only way I've been able to access those types of lists is fortunately they tend to be in buildings where there's also someone at a desk, a concierge type person at a desk, but of course that's not good enough.
It's interesting when Bill first mentioned this to me a while back, I said to him, "Oh, that sounds a bit like Graham's lift," which I knew what I meant. Yeah, no. But Graham, can you explain? Because there was something that was done to fix that, wasn't there?
Yep, there was. Firstly, Dan, I thought you left Sydney because I was trying to invite you onto the Committee of Blind Citizens New South Wales.
Oh no, that was secondary.
just if I can just go back a step, because I think this is an important question. So there is the newest technology in lifts sets the lifts up with central controls. And the reason that it's likely to become more and more common is that it's actually significant energy saving, because the lifts can be programmed to go to different places and pick people up rather than what previously happened was pretty random pressing of the button. So there's a real benefit to these new systems. And when it was proposed for the building in which the Human Rights Commission is housed, I said, well, that's fine, but it has to be an accessible system, and Michael Small and I were on the case, it took some significant negotiation. But these systems can be made accessible. So this is not a question of the technological solution, it's a question of the attitude. Mm. And so what you do is you go to a number of different places in the building and you press the buttons on a telephone at the commission. You press the buttons on a telephone keypad. There is a touch screen, but there's also a press button telephone keypad. And at the commission, as well as showing you on the touch screen which lift you need to go to, there's an announcement of the name of the lift car, number 6 or number 1. And also there's a bell or a ping that occurs above the door of that lift, so that you can then walk towards that door and go into the lift. Now, look, it's not ideal, but it's a viable solution for a problem that's going to become more common, because in new buildings, these lifts will be more and more the normal standard. In relation to Bill's question, my understanding is that the lift standard hasn't yet been revised to take these sorts of systems into account, but that Michael is doing some work to ensure that the access issues are included in the standard. But that knowledge is a little bit dated, so it's probably worth some follow-up.
Okay. Thanks, Graham. John, do you want to pick up on blind
spots? I just want to pick up on the other issue that Bill raised there about the future of internal navigation issues or products such as the iBeacons. We had as a guest this morning in the room a fellow who was actually a BCA member but is also an access consultant by the name of David Forum. And David has actually established a link with the Blind Squared people, and he's very interested in doing some work around this whole area of the standards and how we get some systemic approach to the use of that sort of technology, not necessarily that particular product, but that sort of technology. And he and I have a commitment to follow up after today to progress that work. Now, that's news that not even the President knew before then. So.
It happens all the time. I'm the last to know. Any other questions?
Yes, it's, this microphone's not on.
Yes, it is.
Oh, okay. Doesn't sound. It's Debbie Cook here. Actually, it's not really a question, but I just want to share a really positive thing. Going back to the the St John of God Hospital I was in. It's a new area. It's only been open a couple of months. They're renovating. And the remote control, which worked the television and the call button, it had Braille at the north position. And also you could feel the buttons on it. They were, they were raised just enough. So I wanted to share that.
Oh, that's great.
Thank you.
Terrific.
Okay, any other questions? Thank you.
Who we got, Bridge?
It's Lauren Hayes. Hi.
Hi, Lauren.
So I might tag team. I think Lauren Henley had a lift comment. Did you want to make that first while we're on topic still, sort of?
Make it fairly quick, though.
Yeah, I didn't... Okay. Because I was just wondering, Graham, about the solution for the lift at the Human Rights Commission, how that goes for people who are deafblind, because I'm not sure what a workable solution would be, but that was just a...
Doesn't
Graham
go well.
Saying for the internet audience and others that it doesn't go well for
doesn't
that
go, doesn't work.
Cohort.
Okay. Okay.
And
good point.
Mine isn't so much a question as more an observation, but I've noticed today that apart from Emma and Vaughan's children, and they don't count because they're sighted.
Yes, they do.
I mean, they're great.
Excuse me.
You're awesome.
You're talking about the future CEO of the organisation. Yeah. She was sitting up here with
She's
us at the head
here
table.
Next to us.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, Lucy.
understand what you're getting at, though, Lauren. Keep going.
There is no one here under 30. One? Okay. Well, that's good. But I think it still says a lot, and it's
I
an
agree.
Issue. There's a whole generation of voices that are missing.
I agree. I think it does, but it says a lot to all of us, and we all have the ability to encourage people to attend these functions. So while, yes, there's a lot of work that organisationally BCA can do, we all have our contacts and so forth. So, you know, that's a responsibility that we have to share among all of us.
It is everybody's responsibility.
No, can I please respond to that? Sorry.
In a minute, because I just want to say one more thing and then you can respond to both of us. The other thing I would say about that is I totally agree with you, Lauren, and I think it's definitely a priority for BCA to engage younger people. What I would like to hear from younger people, from those of you who fall into that category, is some ideas, and not, I don't want to hear them now because we haven't got time, but I want to hear some ideas about what you think that BCA needs to focus on in order to bring young people into this conversation, these kinds of conversations. Because my sense is, I mean, I'm not that old, although I'm getting there, but my sense is that what we need to do, thanks, Luce. My sense is what we need to do is actually find the things or the topics that are going to engage younger people. So I'd like to hear from you what they are, because it's all very well for all of us to say, and I say it all the time, by the way, we need more young people in the organisation. What are we going to do? But I need to hear solutions. So tell me what they are, and I'm happy to hear them. Do you want to respond quickly?
Sure. So that's probably a conversation that we could have another time. But
I'm sure
what John said about that we need to tell people to come. Well, I'm sorry, and I've been on the planning committee, but I don't care. I'm going to say it anyway. It's not interesting enough to tell people to come. Young people would not be engaged, I don't think, with much of the content that we've had here today.
Yep, and I take that point on board, and I think part of it is how we spin the content. I actually think that there are a lot of things that occurred today that young people would have perhaps been very interested in, but I think we have to think about how we actually market ourselves and how we actually market the information in a way that is engaging to younger people. But I reckon this is a conversation for a glass of wine or 10.
It's Carmel.
Oh, six. Okay, yes.
Yeah, sorry, Emma.
Yes,
it's Carmel. Just talking about people under 30. I think we have to also acknowledge this is not a format that under 30s happy to work with. Like, we have to get a bit smarter in the way we do things.
I agree.
Sitting around a table is not what they do.
No.
You know, and I do think actually the NDIS discussion is very important for a lot of the people under other blind people under 30, but it's something that they've missed out on. But we have to work out another way of working or, you know, having people under 30 with us.
Yeah. I also do know that one of the things that I have observed, anecdotally that is, because I don't have exact numbers, is that a lot of people under 30, or more people under 30, would probably engage with the stream. That's my sense, from what I've heard from people. But, you know, there is one other thing I'm going to say, and it's a bit controversial, and that is that sometimes not all these issues are going to be fun and exciting. And, you know, I remember sitting in a room at 20 listening to Bill and John and others discuss some of these issues. Sorry, but it's true. And I'm serious, and thinking, gee, some of this is a bit dry. I don't really know what this is about. But realised very quickly that these were really important issues. So there is also a responsibility that goes the other way, that says young people actually have to step up too.
Emma, can I just add one final thing to that conversation? And that is that one of the issues that we have to address here is the fact that the evidence shows that younger people who are blind and vision impaired aren't so keen to mix with other people in that same category.
Mm.
Dale just reminded me of the situation with blind cricket, where they struggle to recruit anyone under 30 now. They've gone over the years from having six teams with adequate numbers of players down to four that they can't fill properly.
Mm.
And the average age of the cricketers is, I'm sorry to remind you of this, Michael Jones, but is getting older and older. There are a number of issues here, and that whole issue of people mixing with their peers.
But it's totally on our agenda. Absolutely assured.
I think
we take
on this some of this stuff for the next national convention. I remember I came to my first national convention in my early 20s, and you know, I think it was in some ways a little bit boring, in some ways quite inspirational, and we need to kind of see how we can do that kind of thing for the next national convention.
Speaking of the next national convention...
Well, segwayed.
That brings me back. It's so good that Dan's here to remind me that I was going to make an announcement about the next national convention. And that is that it will be in Melbourne or somewhere close to. And it will be on the weekend of the 13th to the 15th of October next year. Woo-hoo. So, start.
Can I please? I know organising dates is very hard, but if we're seriously talking about trying to get younger people to come to convention, end of October, start of November, worst time of the year.
Yeah, totally agree. Yeah. Well, this is the 13th to the 15th, so it's not the end of October, but it's getting there. Okay, we will take that on board. We have a whole range of issues that are longer than my arm to consider when we think about these kinds of things. But we will take that on board and have a think about that. But no guarantees. Because one of the important things that we need to think about is, you know, speakers and making sure that we can get make sure that people are available and so forth. John, do you want to talk about a bit more about that?
Not in great detail, but I mean there are a number of factors, and you mentioned speakers and so forth. So are relative costs. The costs of venues, and therefore the cost that we would need to charge for registrations, varies substantially throughout the year. So that's one of the considerations that we'll be taking. But we are looking to the National Convention next year being a truly major event for the organisation, and we're quite likely to have some high-profile international involvement in it.
Yeah. Just one more...
And you're using my time now, so...
Using what?
My time.
Oh, sorry. hang on. Sorry, just one more quick thing that Bill reminded me that I should mention.
Emma, can I make a comment on that, just on that last...
Oh, topic? Sorry. Yeah.
Stephen Jolly here.
Sure.
Being a glass half full person, it's a great weekend to have it, because Sunday the 15th next year, of course, will be International White Cane
Day.
That's
right.
So it'll be a great celebration.
Yep. So, yes, there are lots of considerations. Just one more very brief thing that I wanted to say, because Bill's reminded me about it, is that as a result of my trip to the World Blind Union General Assembly, I became aware that United Airlines has a touchscreen for their entertainment, which in itself is bad enough, but also that when I wanted to call the flight attendant, I couldn't, because in fact the call button is now built into the touchscreen. Not only that, but I also wanted to get onto Wi-Fi so I could do some work for BCA, because that's pretty much all I seem to do these days. And yeah, that's right. Well, you weren't there actually. But when I actually tried to log into my Wi-Fi, they had a visual capture. And I had to get, because I couldn't call the flight attendant to ask them to come and do it for me, I had to get the person next to me to assist. So consequently, I have lodged a complaint with the Human Rights Commission about that. I would really strongly encourage anyone else who's experienced issues of that nature to do the same. I've had no response to that complaint yet, but the other thing to note is that when I did complain to United, they told me that my complaint, they couldn't tell me what would happen to it, and they couldn't tell me whether or when somebody might get back to me. So that did upset me just a little bit. So yeah, just wanted to let you know that you're not the only ones who lodge complaints. Now I'm going to hand back to John.
Thanks, Emma. And I wanted on the record that this conference is going to run 3.5 minutes over time, and it will be Emma's fault.
It'll be my fault.
I did want to say some thank yous in a minute, but before I do, quite seriously, someone has lost the tip off their long cane, and that makes the cane actually quite dangerous for you and for anyone else. It's not the big rural spinning ball tip. It's the other sort of finer fiberglass tip, so it's up here on the front table. And there was a pair of headphones lost, was there? And so Dale has been using those all day, so he thanks you for that. But look, I do want to thank you. I do want to at this stage acknowledge the listeners through our internet stream. We calculate that at least 25 people have listened at some point during the day today. So that's significantly expanded the attendance at this event. And in handing the internet audience back to Vaughan Bennison to sign off, I just want to say thank you to those people and remind everyone that the next event on the BCA Events channel will be coverage of our annual general meeting in 2 weeks' time. So, internet listeners, back to Vaughan Bennison. And that's my radio job. But some arrangements for tonight's dinner and then some thank yous. The conference dinner will be held in this room, commencing at 7 o'clock. We'll be seated at probably 5 tables, 8 people per table. There's not fixed seating. And we really want to encourage you to not just sit with the group of people who you might be related to if you're a Jolly or a Simpson, or you might know quite well if you're a Bennison, but to mix it up so that we share our company and make some new friends throughout the evening. So the dinner here at 7 o'clock. When I do say that we've finished, I'd ask you to leave this room as quickly and as possible, because the hotel staff have a limited time to reset the room for tonight's dinner. In relation to the dinner, it's a cash bar. So there'll be a bar set up in one end of this room for us. There will be hotel staff to wait at tables, but you'll make the service much quicker if you can use the eyes and legs of those who've got better mobility access to go to the bar. And I strongly urge Emma Bennison and others that you have cash with you, because you'll slow the service down if you're trying to use a credit card. And apart from that, I'll announce in a minute Emma Bennison's room number so we can just charge everything there. Okay. Wells will teach you to run overtime. I think it's been a great day. I hope you do too. I have worked with a committee that have put a lot of time and effort into this day, and I do want to acknowledge the committee members, among whom Michael Janes, Helen Ferris, Lauren Hayes, Christine Simpson are all here today, and I thank you for your efforts as part of that small but hard-working team. I want to thank Dale Simpson for his work in establishing the audio facility. You know, we didn't get access to this room until after 6 o'clock this morning, so while you were all dragging yourself out of bed and thinking about breakfast, or if you were Lucy Bennison, a swim in the pool, that's right, Dale was here setting up these facilities. So I acknowledge his efforts, along with Vaughan Bennison, who has hosted our internet coverage. And while I think of it, don't forget to listen to New Horizons. It's a great show with a new theme this year. So Vaughan, thank you for your work today and with New Horizons. We've had some great volunteers working with us, and Bridget Jolly was among those, Paula Barling, Tammy Simpson, and who have I missed? And Michael Janes, of course, although I was going to come to Michael separately. But thank you to you all for your efforts, and thank you to everyone else who helped out when we were a bit short-handed in serving lunches and doing those sorts of things. It was great to see that that team work. I want to thank all of our speakers and panel members and session chairs for their efforts, not only today, but the preparation that they put in today. And I know she's gone now, but I do want to record a very special vote of thanks for Dorothy Hamilton for coming out. Dorothy was, in fact, quite ill in the last 24 hours, but being the sort of person that she is, she gritted her teeth and came along today, and that was fantastic. I want to thank the hotel staff who have been so supportive, and no doubt will continue to be with the dinner this evening. And finally, I want to thank each and every one of you for registering, coming along, being part of the discussions. These events don't have any substance to them without your input. And finally, I want to thank the BCA staff, Ricky Chaplin, who's here today, Lauren Henley, who we've roped back into the team, at least on a part-time basis, and the person back in the office who's done all the work with registrations and so forth, Samantha Marsh, who had an excuse for not being here today. It was Ramona's 51st birthday, and they were up in the Yarra Valley drinking wine while we were working here. So thank you to everyone. It's been a great day. And Emma has, as usual, the last word.
Oh, Jesus. I don't know now. I'm thinking I won't say what I was going to say. I was actually going to say a huge thank you to John Simpson for all of his work in coordinating today. He's done an enormous amount of work behind the scenes. He's quite modest, obviously. But a huge thank you, and I think a round of applause for John. Yeah.